Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Shuttle Pod. This is episode 10, and today is Wednesday, January the 13th, 2016. I am Kaylee Iacovino, and I'm joined, as ever, by our intrepid hosts, Jared Whitley and Brian Drew. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey, everybody. Sorry I missed last time.
Oh, we're glad to have you back. We are very excited to be joined today by a very special guest, James Kerwin. You may know him from his work on Star Trek Continues. He's been the writer and director of several of their episodes. You may also know some of his other work, including the sci-fi noir film Yesterday Was a Lie, which earned a number of prizes on the film festival circuit back in 2008-2009, and from his more recent short sci-fi film RUR Genesis. He is a fellow of the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures, and Commerce. He's a member of Mensa. Very brilliant guy. He's not only a filmmaker, he's also a student of astronomy and physics, and lectures on all three of those topics all around the country. So welcome, James. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure, James.
No, it's my pleasure.
Oh, okay. Well, never mind. I stand corrected.
No, seriously, it's an honor to be on here. Thank you, guys.
We're really excited to talk to you about some of your work with Star Trek Continues. And I know the Brian and Jared have a lot of questions that they have on their minds. Why don't you take it away, guys?
Okay, so I was actually, before we started, I was rewatching the most recent episode, Divided We Stand, the one where Kirk and McCoy get sent back to the American Civil War.
Yes.
And the thing, I'm a musician in my personal life, and so I try to pay a lot of attention in movies and TV shows to what they do with the music. And I think that after the cold open, like, they wake up and, you know, they're surprised and they don't know what's going on. And there's this, like, very brassy, very TOS-appropriate, like, rendition of the first few bars of the Star Spangled Banner, and it ends on a minor note so that it's you know, indicating the confusion that our heroes feel. And it's just perfect. Like, tonally, it captures the spirit of the original series just magnificently, just in the music, let alone how everything else works so well in terms of the sets and the actors and the writing and whatnot. And so I guess this is an open-ended question for you. How do you – what are some of the goals you have in capturing the spirit of TOS, and what are some of the little things you pull, like musical cues, to make sure that you successfully execute that?
Yeah, thanks. The cue that was used in that episode was partially, at least, from the Omega Glory. If you remember, there was there were some bars of Star Spangled Banner there. We have an amazing composer conductor named Andy Farber, who is a Juilliard professor actually, and he's up in New York, and he records our scores starting with episode 4 on with a live orchestra. So they're a combination of the original music by Courage and Steiner and all those guys and Fried, and then and new compositions that he creates or that Vic, our executive producer, creates. I can't take credit for episode 5. I neither wrote nor directed that one. So credit where credit is due. Vic directed that episode, and he also chooses the music cues. For the shows. But in general, to answer your question, the idea, I mean, the vision that he had when he established the show, I came on partway through. I started working on the series as a guest director on episode 3, then came on full-time as a story editor on episode 4, and on this next episode, I became a full co-producer. But his goal, his vision for creating, when he created the show, was to basically, of course, show the remainder of the 5-year mission. Something that we've really never gotten in any type of live-action Star Trek. There's this tremendous hole between the end of the original series and the motion picture, and there's a lot of unanswered questions. What happened there? Why did McCoy leave Starfleet? Why did Spock take a sabbatical? Why did the Enterprise need to be refit? How did Kirk get an admiral office job? You know, what happened there? And there's so many more stories that could be told because the show was prematurely canceled. It was getting good ratings, contrary to myth. It was just killed by the network. Network executives just didn't like it, and it was expensive, so they stopped making it. And it's a shame because there were so many more great stories that could have been told. And so his goal was to do that. And to do that, most importantly, in the style that it would have been done in 1969. So the lenses that we use, the film grain that we use, the lighting tool equipment that we use, the sound effects, the music, everything, even in a sense, the style of the acting is all pulled straight from Star Trek, the original series, right where the show ended.
That's what astounded me, James, when I watched the first clip that they made of Turnabout Intruder.
Yes.
I mean, they literally got it down to the film grain.
Yeah.
That is the only fan production I've ever seen that actually captured how the original series actually looked.
Yeah.
The lighting, everything about it is so spot on. It was almost creepy how good it was.
Yeah. Well, a lot of credit goes to our director of photography, Matt Busey. Who's just an absolute genius. He can look at a photograph and tell you exactly where every light was placed, how bright each light was, what type of light they were, how far off camera they were. And I mean, so we'll go through episodes and he'll just look at shots and he'll say, okay, well, this is how they lit that shot. Here's exactly where the lights were, and he can duplicate it exactly. And then he also color grades the footage in post. And then we grain it, and we do all those kind of things. I mean, we also do things that I think hit people subconsciously that they may not be consciously aware of, and I'll give you an example of that. The end credits of Star Trek, the original series, well, back in the 60s, in order to superimpose titles over stills, what they had to do is they had to run that thing through an optical printer quite a few times. They pulled still frames from work prints, not from the original negatives, from work prints of previous episodes. So that's why they're a little more contrasty and a little more grainy. Then they would run them through optical printers, put the credits onto them, but because of the way that they superimposed the cards on there, they couldn't quite get sharp edges, so they're slightly out of focus, just ever so slightly, just like one point out of focus. And then because they ran them through an optical printer so many times, it accumulated a little bit of film dirt and what we call judder, which is slight horizontal motion of the frame. We do all of that.
Really?
That's incredible.
We do that. Yeah. I mean, if you watch our end credits, that's what they look like. I mean, we don't just take stills and put titles on them in Final Cut Pro and call it a day. We spend days making each title sequence of the end titles look exactly like they did back then. And just even if you don't get it, even if you don't know what it is, just watching it, you get that feel, you know, you get the sense.
Absolutely.
That this is something that was made back then.
Well, the care you guys put into it is very, very obvious.
Oh yeah,
it's such a labor of love, and it comes through.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. What you guys do is absolutely wonderful.
I think the most important part of that, which you guys hit, just you know, as magnificently as you need to. Is the way the lead actor, I don't know if I'm going to say his last name correctly, so I apologize, Victor Mignogna?
Am
I saying his name right? Yeah, he's got the exact physicality of William Shatner in the 60s, right? Just the way he holds himself and the way he shifts himself suddenly around the bridge is just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Got the perfect Kirk swagger.
Yeah, it is, without being a caricature, right? And that's the problem with something like this, is if he sounds like, somebody from Saturday Night Live doing an imitation of William Shatner, then the illusion is shattered.
Right. Well, and again, and that was also one of his dictums that has carried on through the past couple of years as I joined the project as well, which is we hire professionals. I mean, there's professionals in front of the camera and there's professionals behind the camera. You know, if you cast a fan film with fans, it's going to look like fans trying to act. If you cast a fan film with professional actors from L.A., it's going to look like professional. It's going to look professional. And, you know, we're really lucky to have a cast that gets it, you know, that gets these original characters that they're trying to duplicate, makes them their own without, like you said, trying to mimic them. Because when you get into mimicry, it looks silly. So they make them their own, but at the same time, they have those slight mannerisms and those slight intonations that that throw back to the way those characters were originally played. You know, Todd Haberkorn isn't playing Nimoy playing Spock. Todd Haberkorn is playing Spock.
Yeah.
And that's the same with Vic. Vic isn't doing a Shatner impression of doing Kirk. He's playing Kirk. And that's how we approach it with all of the actors.
The other thing I noticed, you know, and body image is an issue that gets brought up in the media a lot, especially in movies and whatnot, is all the actresses look like Nichelle Nichols, not like Zoe Saldana, if I can say that. Right? Is that okay? They conform to more of a sort of curvy 60s aesthetic rather than kind of a rail thin modern aesthetic, right? And so, I just feel like
Michelle,
at every
Michelle
single level
thin.
It works.
I know,
maybe
Michelle was pretty thin.
What's that?
Michelle was pretty thin.
Well, yeah, but she was curvy.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I guess I didn't get the point. Sorry.
Oh no, I just feel at every level the aesthetics capture the feel of the 1960s show.
Thank you. Yeah, that's it. I mean, from, you know, our costumes, our makeup, all of those things, you know, the techniques that are used, the material, the fabric that we sourced to make these costumes from, when we had to go back and do, when we did an episode for your listeners who might not be familiar with it, we did an episode called Fairest of Them All, which was a sequel to Mirror Mirror, taking place in the Mirror universe right after the events of Mirror Mirror happened. Well, our series takes place in what is ostensibly the fourth season. So all of our sets and our costumes are the third season versions. The transporter room is purple, and it's got that little alcove thing on the side. Engineering is the third season version of engineering. The costumes are made out of that nylon material as opposed to the velour, because that's how it was in the third season. Well, when we decided to go back, flashback into a second season episode, everything had to be redone.
we had to move
the flats, we had to paint the doors, we had to paint the walls, we had to get new fabric for the uniforms. And cotton velour, which the uniforms were made out of in the first two seasons of TOS, pretty much doesn't exist anymore. They make velour out of polyester now. Polyester is an artificial fabric. It glistens in the light. So we couldn't do that. So we had to spend an enormous amount of time finally finding cotton velour and then dyeing it to match the exact colors of those three colors back then. So like just that kind of OCD level obsessive compulsive stuff is what really just, I think, makes it feel, like I said before, even if you don't notice these things, you subconsciously notice them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that ties into like some other questions that I have, something that maybe you can discuss a little bit more, and it's this thing that you mentioned, sort of this OCD level attention to detail, which of course I think both of us say that in a loving way. It's just this very, you know, this sort of encyclopedic knowledge of Star Trek that's required to reproduce it in such an incredible detailed way. And one of the things that's really interesting to me is the idea of the cartography of the Star Trek universe, of our galaxy in the landscape of Star Trek, and, you know, where things are. So like when you're writing an episode, you know, how much do you have to consider, you know, where, like if you're either inventing a new planet or you're using an established planet that's in an established location, like where it is in the universe and how long it's going to take to get there. So my interest is in, like, you know, in the original series in 1966, you know, they used warp factor in so many different ways. Like, and, you know, it's one of the things that's famously hard to pin down, like how fast is warp 1 or warp 5? So how do you take, because obviously when you're making a Star Trek story today, you have to stay true to so much canon that has been developed.
Yeah.
And so how do you stay true to that when implementing things like warp factor 5, like, you know, how fast is warp factor 5?
Well, I mean, a huge part of it is the fact that they were making up as they went along back then. And there are little inconsistencies from one point to another that subsequent series and subsequent fans have tried to retcon and figure out how does that work with this and how does that work with this. And interestingly, if you add it all up, it kind of does make sense. I mean, despite what would on the surface appear to be contradictions, there actually are cogent explanations for everything. So, and that, of course, like you said, with all the modern, the universe of Trek has expanded so much with all the modern series and the films since TOS, that we now have a really, really clear sense of where everything is in the galaxy, what these different warp factors are. And the warp factors, the warp scale was recalibrated between the different series. So warp 5 in TOS is not anything like warp 5 in TNG. And those of all that, Mike Okuda and Larry Nemechek and Sternbach and all those guys, they figured all that stuff out. And we're really lucky to have Larry, for example, as our creative consultant on the show. He also stood in to play McCoy in the first two episodes when our regular McCoy, Chuck Huber, wasn't available. So Larry's been involved with the show from early on, and you know, he wrote Stellar Cartography, which is like the gold standard book of the galaxy,
gorgeous
the map
book.
Of the galaxy.
Amazing book.
If you don't have this, you got to get this book. And you know, Stellar Cartography and the earlier book Star Charts and Star Trek Online, all of which pretty much gel with each other. That's pretty much a gold standard of where everything is. And we go by that. I mean, we have to. I mean, they wouldn't have cared that much back then, but I care. Like, if I'm writing an episode, I know that a fan is going to pick on me if I have something, if I have a planet somewhere where it's not supposed to be, or if I have the amount of time it takes the Enterprise to get to, say, Kronos or something wrong. I have to get all that stuff right. So that's where Larry comes in, and that's where all these maps come in. And yeah, I'm pretty anal retentive about that cartography stuff and getting it right.
A thing that was amazing to me, and I mean, I guess some people won't find this interesting, but I think a lot of people don't realize, as I didn't, that a lot of the Star Trek universe a lot of the planets that we know and love are actually in the Beta Quadrant. So I was actually looking over the Stellar Cartography book with James, and we were sitting and looking at these maps, and I think James said something about something being in the Beta Quadrant. I'm like, no, it can't be in the Beta Quadrant.
Yeah.
It's in the Alpha Quadrant, of course. Like, everything is in the Alpha Quadrant. And he's like, no. Earth, or the Sol System, I guess, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the dividing line between the Alpha and Beta Quadrants. So that half of the year, the Earth is in the Beta Quadrant, and the other half is in the Alpha Quadrant.
Yep, that's right. The idea is that shortly after the you know, Earth really started venturing out there and met these other worlds like the Tellarites and the Andorians and the Vulcans and founded the Federation and so forth, that, you know, the Federation is very Earth-centric, and people find that funny, mm-hmm. but that is one of the conceits of Star Trek, and they even addressed that in Enterprise.
Star Trek VI, where she says the Federation is a Homo sapiens-only club.
Right. Right. Yes, they did. They did. But in Enterprise, they kind of, I think, took it a step further and explained why, and they kind of talked about the fact that humans have this unique capacity to explore and lead that other species who are even more technologically advanced and have been out in space for longer simply don't have. So humans were like the ideal race to found the Federation. And so the decision was made early on that the galaxy would be divided into four quadrants, and what's called the Galactic Meridian, the north-south, so to speak, line, goes straight through the sun. So the Sol is directly on the border between the Alpha and Beta quadrants. Many of the founding worlds of the Federation are slightly on the Beta side. Vulcan is on the Beta side. Hmm. Andoria and Andor are on the beta side. Talar Prime is just on the Alpha side. Alpha Centauri is on the Beta side. Risus, Orion, like so many things are on the Beta side, including the entire Klingon and Romulan empires.
Oh, really? Well,
yeah. So an enormous amount of the Star Trek universe takes place in the Beta Quadrant, and Ron Moore actually addressed that back when they were working on Deep Space Nine. Some fans said, why do you guys always refer to the, quote, Alpha Quadrant powers? You know, the Dominion's coming for the Alpha, and they're coming into the Alpha Quadrant. They've made inroads into the Alpha Quadrant. Aren't you really talking about Alpha/Beta? And Ron Moore said, yes, we are keenly aware of the fact that we're talking about both, but we, as writers, made the decision that in common parlance in the 23rd and 24th century, this whole area of the galaxy is by slang just kind of referred to as the Alpha Quadrant. But even though a huge portion of it is in the Beta Quadrant.
Well, you know, we kind of do the same when we talk about Western civilization. I mean, we tend to use that to describe, you know, North America and Europe, right? But Europe is technically in the Eastern Hemisphere, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a good point.
And it's also kind of the reverse way of the way, you know, the entire Western Hemisphere is called America, but when we say America, we mean the United States.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of like the opposite of that. They just use a term to describe something bigger. But, yeah, so, and I think a lot of it, and Moore also said, and I have no reason to doubt him, that this was a conscious decision on the writer's part not to confuse viewers, because it's just laborious to constantly have to, oh, that's happening in beta, but this is happening in alpha, and like more, you know, viewers who are not following it that carefully might not understand the difference and where that is compared to that. So, but yeah, the reality is an enormous amount of stuff is in the beta quadrant.
Because the only time I remember them referring to the beta quadrant is in Star Trek VI, where Sulu says, you know, they're trying to get to the Kittimer Accords. He says, oh, we're still in the beta quadrant right now. I don't remember otherwise them ever...
cataloging gaseous anomalies.
Gaseous anomalies, exactly. Things got to have a tailpipe.
Yeah.
That explains, too, then, why we never hear about the beta quadrant, but why, you know, why viewers assume everything is in the alpha quadrant.
Right. Because like I said, I mean, I would venture to say that a majority of both TOS and TNG took place in beta. Obviously not the DS9 Voyager, because those were another, but and Enterprise. I mean, the majority of that stuff really took place in the beta quadrant. I mean, the alpha quadrant is very largely Cardassian space and Bajor and Deep Space Nine, Breen space, Ferengi Alliance is there, Tholians are there, but all the neutral zones, the Romulans, the Klingons, the old Iconian Empire that was referred to in TNG, and you know, all of that is all on the beta side. And the other thing that I have to stipulate here is that the term quadrant is funny because, yeah, if you look at the galaxy as a disk straight down, divided into four, yeah, those are the four quadrants. But the amount of the alpha quadrant that is actually covered in Star Trek is, I think Larry estimates, is about 2% of the actual quadrant of that space. And the same with the beta quadrant. So, like, the amount of explored space in the Trekverse is incredibly small. I mean, we're nowhere near. So that's why when you go to the Delta Quadrant, when Voyager was thrown way across to the other side of the Delta Quadrant, it would take them 8 decades to get back, and it really genuinely would. The distances do make sense. If you and like, that's another thing. People threw a fit about the fact that in Enterprise, you know, they said a Warp 5 vessel could go from Earth to Kronos in a week. They're like, oh, it's too far away. It's really not. It's right there. I mean, this is a tiny, tiny, tiny little fraction of a fraction of the galaxy. The Klingon Empire is not that far from Earth. And you just have to bear in mind that they're not traveling these great galactic distances. They're traveling in a handful of sectors in a very tiny, tiny portion of the galaxy.
I still have a hard time believing that, as established in the previous film, we could beam to Kronos.
Wow. Well,
that's in the alternate. That's in the alternate.
Wow. Sticking it.
I'm not going to stop bringing that up.
No, you're right to do that.
So, like, yeah, when thinking about these things in the context of Star Trek Continues, I guess I have a couple of questions. So you mentioned the idea of retconning things that were initially seen as problems or contradictions in the original series. So my first question would be, A, would you ever consider, like, putting a retcon directly in Star Trek Continues to try to explain something that wasn't previously explained? And my second question, which is sort of goes in tandem with that, is, have you ever had a moment where you've either made a mistake or, you know, made a controversial choice about something that went into an episode?
Well, the answer to your first question is, I wish I could answer that, but it would be spoilers. So,
nice, perfect internet answer.
You know, I will say this. There's we try very much in STC not to refer to things. I mean, Vic's whole initial conceit was, this is made in 1969. We don't do anything that couldn't have been done then. Very quickly, we realized that that's kind of needlessly restricting us in certain areas. One of the areas is visual effects. You know, if we really did the visual effects the way they would have done them back then, they would look pretty bad. So, I mean, we fudge on that a little bit. I mean, Doug Drexler, who's just an amazing, amazing visual effects artist who did the actual series and now is our guy. He does our Enterprise model and all the space effects. You know, he makes it look kind of like that, but he modernizes it slightly. And so we're constantly trying to ride that line. The same thing with canon references. If an issue comes up in the show that kind of it requires a canon reference to one of the later series, then we'll put it in there as long as it's either absolutely necessary to the plot, like in Leilani, for example, it was really necessary to refer to something that happened in Enterprise, or else the plot would not have made sense. So if it's necessary to the plot, we'll do it. Or if it's just kind of like a wink, like Chekhov refers to the Zindi in episode 4, you know, just a little little wink like that that doesn't really matter, we'll do that. But we certainly are not going to build any major plots around points that happened in the later series. But as far as addressing certain things that have maybe people have questions about, like I said, I can't answer that. You'll have to keep watching.
That's exciting. Speaking of things that are coming, when is the next episode coming out?
Yeah.
Episode 6 is in the can. We're in post-production on it right now. It should be released, I'm guessing, around April or May.
Great.
So, yeah.
Cool.
And then in answer to your other question, yeah, I made a huge mistake in episode 4. Kirk refers to the cloud creature attack on the Farragut having been 7 years ago. And sharp-eyed fans, when it was released, immediately said, no, it was 13 years before this. And they're absolutely right. That was literally just a brain fart on my part when I did the math. So we brought Vic dubbed the line, and we recut the episode.
Oh,
and
awesome.
We released it with a corrected line in there. Yeah.
That is dedication. To actually go back and correct that.
That's hardcore. Yeah. Very cool.
How much time passes from concept to seeing it drop on the internet?
You know, there is no real set time. It really varies from episode to episode. There are some episodes that we'll have thought of, you know, a year in advance and just kind of been mulling it over in the back of our heads, and you know, eventually it gets turned into a script and then we shoot it. And then other ones go from idea to screen fairly quickly. Fairest of Them All went from idea to screen fairly quickly. Episode 6, it will be almost a year and a half between when the initial concept came up. Greg Dykstra, who's a great visual effects guy, he works at Pixar. He's done a ton of films. He was heavily involved in the production of Episode 6. He played Dr. Heath in Episode 5, and he wrote Episode 6. And from his initial idea to the release of the episode is going to be about a year and a half.
Wow.
So it varies.
You guys have a huge fan base at Pixar, don't you?
But you know what? It's interesting. They really like our episodes, and every time an episode is released, Vic goes up there and screens it for the employees
at
Pixar.
Oh, cool.
And several of us have gone up and visited those guys as well. And Lisa Hansel, our makeup artist, has, and Casey Shasky, our unit production manager, has. Kipley has. I have. It's a great. It's really fun to tour Pixar.
Yeah, I believe it.
It's got to be so flattering. I mean, you're talking about some of the greatest storytellers in the world live in that building.
Yeah, they do.
And they want to see your work. I mean, that is really heavy stuff.
They do. And I don't mean to in any way insinuate that they're somehow like promoting our work or putting their name behind it or anything like that. It's not like that. It's just there's a lot of people that are simply fans. And they love watching our episodes. And that is very flattering.
I wanted to ask you, do you guys have a master plan for how many episodes you plan on doing to complete the 5-year mission?
Yes.
And?
I think that's the only answer I'm going to get.
Yes, that is the answer. We are actually, we do have an overall story mapped out of what we want to do with this. I'm not sure I should say the specific details of how many yet, but I can say this.
Okay.
We've done, the initial episode was funded by Vic entirely and Steven Dengler, our co-executive producer, who plays Drake, by the way, in our series. They believe very strongly that they needed to kind of put their money where their mouth is and show what they could do as producers before they ever went to any type of crowdfunding. So the first episode was entirely funded by Vic and also by Steven. And then after that, they did a crowdfunding campaign to produce the next few episodes, another crowdfunding campaign to produce the next few. And I believe around the end of February, we're going to start our next one, which is going to fund a significant chunk of the remainder of the 5-year mission. So keep your eyes open for that.
Absolutely, we will.
Very cool.
So speaking of kickstarting and fan films, I think this is a good time to bring up one of the perhaps elephant in the rooms. I'm not sure, but and you know, I
The pet
realize that
Celot
maybe
in the room.
That's right. That's what we're going with.
That's
That's right.
Right.
The Celot in the room. Of course, I'm talking about the Axanar lawsuit, which for I'm sure everyone who's listening is aware, but just as a brief recap, the fan film Axanar, which was a goal to create a full-length feature film, I guess, of the story of Garth of Izar, and had been raising a ton of money. They raised about $1 million on Kickstarter and were recently sued by CBS and Paramount for copyright infringement. And I realize, James, you're not involved in that production, and there's maybe not much you can say about it. But of course, a lot of the question, one of the biggest questions on people's mind when this came out was, how is this going to affect other fan films? Is this something that you guys have to worry about? Is this going to hurt your funding efforts? So, I mean, what is your reaction to this?
Yeah, I mean, it's really unfortunate that this all came to a head like this. I don't know those guys particularly well. I've met Alec a couple of times. I do know Rob Burnett, their director, quite well. I've been friends with him for years. So it's a shame that this happened. As far as I know, it doesn't appear to be any type of broad stroke banhammer on all fan films. We certainly haven't heard anything to that extent. We've always tried to be, I mean, we will run into situations from time to time in which we will be offered an opportunity to do something or planning to do something. And, you know, we'll directly contact CBS Legal and say, is it okay to do this? And, you know, if they say no, we don't do it. So to the best of my knowledge, I don't think it's a broad stroke thing. It would really suck if it is, obviously, for all fan films. But right now, we're not, I mean, we don't get that sense, so we're moving forward with our next episode and our next crowdfunder in February until we hear differently, you know?
Good.
Sure. Well, it's good to hear that, you know, it's not affecting you guys as far as their day-to-day operations go.
Yeah, it's certainly not. I mean, we're moving forward. We're moving forward on episode six. Like I said, we're heavy in post on it right now. And prepping for our next one and one after that. So it's a busy time.
That's great. Yeah, yeah. It's funny. It's, you know, I've written a few articles about tons of different fan films for Trek Movie. And in every one of them, I always have to remark at how we really seem to be in this golden age of fan films where we have, you know, Star Trek Continues until recently, Axanar, Renegades, Phase 2, Starship Farragut, like, just tons and tons of great fan productions happening, and they're just getting more and more professional looking, and they're getting more and more interesting. And so it's I'm glad to hear that. Hopefully, like, this is, it's not like this whole fan film thing is coming to an end or anything like that. It sounds like so hopefully we can continue to enjoy this, like, as I like to refer to it, the golden era of fan films.
Yeah, and Farragut actually is in there. Farragut partnered with STC for the past couple of years. We shared a studio, and until Farragut decided that they're going to be moving into the, I guess they're going to be skipping ahead 12 years into, like, the Wrath of Khan era.
Mm-hmm.
In
oh,
their
cool.
Series.
Mm-hmm. Very
and
cool.
So their final episode on the TOS era Farragut, they're actually shooting right now at the studio. And then they're moving out of the studio and building the Wrath of Khan bridge.
Wow.
So that'll be cool. So yeah,
I know they were recently doing another Kickstarter. I'm not sure if it's still going. I think
no, they finished that.
Just finished.
It was successful, and they're shooting it right
That's
now.
Fantastic.
Wow. That'll be the first time I think a fan production has tried to build the refit. Wrath
yeah,
I know, I know. I'm just like, wow, that's a tall order, man. That's gonna be hard to build.
Yeah, those are like a lot of vacuum formed shapes and like very
yeah.
exotic
yeah.
kind of design.
Yeah,
maybe they can 3D print some of that
oh,
stuff.
Oh yeah,
who knows.
James, I wanted to ask you, how long does it take to typically shoot an episode?
Usually about between 9 and 11 days, depending on how complex the episode is. That's about our average. I think the first couple episodes were shot less than in short amounts of time, but right now we're averaging about 9 or 10 days.
That seems pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, it's about average for a TV show,
okay.
Frankly. You know, it's about normal. You know, one thing that we're kind of lucky is that we're not restricted to network timetables. Back then, every episode had to be 51 minutes, period, and that was it. And today, every episode has to be 41 minutes, and that's it. And you don't get to vary from that at all. We're lucky in that we're internet exhibition, obviously, so we don't have to worry that much about that. So we try to keep our episodes between 41 and 51 minutes, in that range. If the story feels like it's moving at a pace that it should be told in 41 minutes, like Ferris of the Mall, for example, we'll tell it in 41. If a story needs 51 minutes to tell, like Leilani, we'll tell it in 51. So we're flexible when it comes to that. But in general, we try to shoot about 5.5 pages of the script a day. And if you do the math after, 9 or 10 days, that's a full episode.
So this is one of those instances where you felt that the restriction of sticking exactly to how they would have done it in 1969 was too much, and you gave a little bit of leeway to yourselves with that one.
Well, yeah, we did. And it's funny because some people have given us crap about it, but whatever. It's funny because everybody says, well, the only reason TV shows are 41 minutes today instead of 51 is because there's just more commercials. Well,
right.
That's partially true. But it's also true that we've kind of realized over time that that's kind of an ideal length to tell a concise story. And, if you watch the TOS episodes in syndication today on a broadcast channel, they skip along pretty fast. And then if you go back and watch the Blu-rays, the original 51 minutes cuts, you see a lot of what we call padding.
Yeah.
Cut to a reaction shot of McCoy. Cut to a reaction shot of Spock. Back to a reaction shot of McCoy. Back to a reaction shot of Kirk.
Huh. I never realized that they were showing a different cut when they aired them on television.
They cut 10 minutes out of
That's
their
episode
huge. When they air them today. Yeah. But you know what? There are some that you feel where the cuts are, and you're like, oh, that doesn't make any sense. But for the most part, they feel pretty tight.
At 41.
And like all, Enterprise was 41 minutes. I think TNG through Voyager were like 45, I think, something like that, because that's what the standard was then. And even TNG, when it's aired in syndication today, they cut 4 minutes.
Interesting.
Wow.
It's a good length, but it's good having the flexibility, I think, because we've done, I think our episode lengths have been 51, 51, 41, 48, and 43, of the five episodes so far. So we're keeping in that range, but we want to tell the story as best we can, and we don't feel it necessary to keep ourselves to a very specific time restriction. I don't really see any reason why we would do that.
Would you ever do a two-parter?
Spoilers.
Sorry.
Well, spoilers.
Ooh, oh, I can't wait for the next
very
episode.
Cryptic. Okay, so if we want to move on and talk about some other current events going on in the Trek universe currently.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Okay, so
certainly, by all means.
So the Star Trek Beyond trailer dropped a few weeks ago. And this is really the first we've seen of what this installment is going to be like without J.J. Abrams at the helm. We got to see Idris Elba as his villain for the first time. What has been your general reaction to the Abrams verse, and what creatively have been things that you've seen and said, oh, that's interesting that they did that? Which is to say, I'm trying to ask an open-ended, more positive question rather than maybe dredging up some of the negative things that some people may believe about the Abrams verse.
Yeah, I am not an Abrams verse hater. I'm not a huge fan either. But it for me it is what it is, and it served its purpose, and it is serving its purpose. I think the cool thing about Star Trek is that it's kind of infinitely I don't want to say reinventable, because it is all one cohesive universe, but stylistically it's reinventable. And, if you look at the difference between TOS and Voyager, there's a massive difference in style or Enterprise or whatever. I don't really, or the difference between the motion picture and Wrath of Khan. I mean, talk about a difference in style.
Sure.
I understand that it's not the Star Trek that a lot of people wanted it to be. I completely respect that. I'm not invalidating that at all. At the same time, for me, I really didn't hate it. I mean, I certainly watched it and said, that doesn't really have the depth that a lot of TOS did or a lot of the films did, but or TNG or DS9. But it is what it is. It's a fun story, and I liked the first two films. I liked Into Darkness. I thought that, Rod Roddenberry and I were talking about this actually very recently, about how there's a lot of things in Into Darkness that are, despite the things people might not like about it, there's plenty, to pick on. I'm not saying there's not. Especially that God!
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. But there's a lot of things in it that kind of harken back to the TOS feeling of let's stop the action and have a deep kind of philosophical conversation about what we're doing here morally and why we're doing it and is it right or not. And they did that several times in that film, which I really liked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't dislike them. I think the trailer for Beyond was obviously Fast and the Furious. I mean, they tried to make it Fast and the Furious. They put from the director of Fast, and they put that on the screen. So obviously, that's what they're trying to do.
And then they include a close-up shot of Captain Kirk revving the throttle of his space motorcycle.
Yes, space motorcycle, and yeah, exactly. I'm not going to judge a film by a teaser trailer. You can't do that. I mean, I'm kind of with Simon Pegg, and I wouldn't have cut the trailer that way, but I can also see why they did if that's the type of audience they're trying to appeal to. I guess I'm just kind of pragmatic about it. I'll wait to see the film before I judge it,
Totally.
I think that's the smartest move, although of course Trekkies everywhere, including us, want to be able to judge it now, so we're just going to talk about it as much as we can.
Here's the thing, people get so upset about the whatever incarnation of Trek they don't like, as if it somehow erases the Treks that they do. If you didn't like that one, don't watch that one. I mean, it's not like this suddenly makes TOS disappear.
Right.
I mean, it's that is all still there. And you can watch it as many times as you want. And there'll be a new series coming out next year. And who knows what that's going to be like. And this will go on and on. And there's a variety of different styles of Star Trek for different people. Not everybody is going to like every single film and every single TV episode of every series. I mean, I certainly have the series that I don't like. That doesn't mean that I'm mad about it.
Right. So. Yeah, the other argument I think is funny is this isn't Star Trek. It's like, well, it is, actually, by definition, and it's canon now, so you have to accept it. It's the same thing. It boils down to the same argument that you just made, which is whether or not you like it doesn't determine whether or not it's quote-unquote Star Trek.
Well, that I love that. I love getting, fans getting into head canon arguments or personal fanon arguments. I personally don't consider Enterprise canon, but I do consider the novels canon. Well, good for you.
Right.
It's completely not your call, but if you want to think that, that's fine.
Yep.
And that phenomenon is not restricted to the fans. I read that Gene Roddenberry considered Star Trek V to not be canon.
And the animated series.
He called it apocryphal.
Okay, there you go. Well, it's tomato, tomato.
Yeah. It is fairly well documented that he didn't consider TAS canon.
Right.
And that was pragmatic. I mean, again, that was a situation where you have to understand why he didn't at the time. When he made the animated series, he genuinely believed this was the only time he would ever be able to explore these characters in this world again. So he basically said, do whatever you want with it and make crazy naked bird creatures and as Federation, do silly stuff. And they did. I'm not picking on the animated series. I think some of the writing is excellent. Some of it is rather silly. But the reality is that once he was given the opportunity to do the films, he quickly realized, well, wait a minute, we want to get back kind of to how TOS was, and there are even things in the films that directly contradict the animated series. Star Trek V, they've never crossed the galactic barrier to go to the galactic center. Well, they did in the animated series, so that's a direct contradiction. Chapel being a doctor in TMP is direct contradiction to her being on the Enterprise at the end of the 5-year mission in TAS, because she would have had to have gone to med school by then. So, and he knew this, and that's why he said, okay, TAS was fun. It's a little thing that we can watch for fun, but it's not like the books. It's not canon. And it really wasn't until CBS got the rights that they kind of didn't come right out and say, now it's canon again, but they kind of led people to believe that by selling them on DVD. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't on Star Trek Continues, we don't we don't go by TAS because we just can't. I mean, it wouldn't fit with what we're doing. So we get that question all the time. What about the animated series? And I say, I think it's a great show. We have to ignore it.
Sure.
For our purpose.
Well, I also think one of the goals of the animated series was to do what you said with Star Trek Continues, which was to fill in the two missing years of the 5-year mission. And so, you can't have both those happening at the same time then.
Right. Well, and that's another thing that people like to argue about is, are there two missing years or are there one? Because if you go by the view screens that are shown in episodes of Voyager and I think Enterprise, we actually saw 4 years of the 5-year mission in TOS, because Where No Man Has Gone Before took place almost 12 months before Corbin.
Oh, interesting.
So technically, one could argue that the space between Where No Man Has Gone Before and Turnabout Intruder was actually covered 4 years.
Oh, I never heard that before.
So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it was clear there was a large gap of time between Where No Man Has Gone Before and the Corbomite maneuver, because the Enterprise undergoes a severe refit.
Yep. The Enterprise is refit. The uniforms are all changed. Half the crew is different. I mean, there's a gap. And Mike Okuda kind of put in the encyclopedia, hey, there's a year gap there. And then I think in both Voyager and Enterprise, there's some point where it's referred to by what years these things happened in. And they kind of officially canonize that there is a year space there. So our, again, with STC, our thing is we're doing the last year. We're doing the fourth season, but it's the last year. So we'll do one season, and then we'll end up with the end of the 5-year mission. So that's it.
The best part of loving Star Trek is hating Star Trek, right? And so if the fans don't have something to argue about, then that's when we know the franchise is really on its last nacelle.
It's the best part of loving Star Trek is either hating Star Trek or hating other fans.
Aww,
and arguing with them. Well, I shouldn't say hating, but arguing with other
there
fans about what is is not canon.
A lively debate.
Lively debate is one thing, but sometimes, like I said, when it gets into headcanon stuff, I mean, people are so, determined. No, I'm telling you, the Canadians did this. Okay, fine. I'm not going to argue with you about it.
Well, James, it's been awesome talking to you. It's like we're getting to the end of our time here, but before we go, I wanted to ask you if there's any other projects you have coming up or what you're currently working on or anything that you want to plug before we end here.
Thank you. Right now, just a lot of work on like I said, we're heavy in post on STC Episode 6, and we're going to be launching our Indiegogo campaign at the end of February for our next few episodes. Separately from STC, I'm also in prep on a feature film called RUR, which is based on the short that you mentioned earlier that stars Chase Masterson and Kipley Brown and Vic Mignogna. And we are in the process of, knock on wood, turning that into a feature film. So we've been in development on that since we released the short about a year and a half ago. So these things take time, but keeping our fingers crossed.
That's great.
So that's what I'm doing.
When can we expect to see any more RUR stuff? Because I really loved that short.
Man, if I had the answer to that, I wish.
Well, we'll keep our eyes open. I think people really liked it.
It got a really good response. I mean, the thing is when you shoot a short and it gets a good response and you decide to turn it into a feature, sometimes that happens really quickly, but a lot of times it takes many years to actually work out the logistics of that. So we're keeping it going. We're talking with different financing companies right now. So.
Good luck.
Very cool. We will look for that.
Yeah, best of luck with it.
We'll also look for the Indiegogo campaign coming up end of February for the next episode of Star Trek Continues. I think everyone's excited to get that funded. And so many people have loved all the 5 episodes that have been out so far. So hopefully you guys will get the same reception you've had for previous episodes on this next one. So I guess that's about it for us here on the Shuttle Pod. If you guys want to get in touch, please do. We hope to hear from you on Twitter at Trek Movie, of course, in the comments section on our website, and either send us an email, comments@trekmovie.com. Tell us what's on your mind, and if you like the episode, and if you have any Trek anecdotes for us. We don't have one for you this week, but we're hoping to get more instances of how Trek invades your daily life. So send us that on Twitter and on the website and on Facebook. And we'll see you guys next time. Thanks, everyone. Thanks again, James, for joining
us. Thanks so much, James.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Guy walks into the doctor's office. The doctor tells him you need an operation. The guy says, I want a second opinion. The doctor says, okay, you're ugly too, but boom, boom.